You know that feeling when your day finally slows down and you just want to relax, unplug, and feel good? That's where Mood.com comes in. They're changing the game, delivering legal THC products right to your door, no shady dealers, and absolutely no medical card required, just good vibes and better sleep, shipped straight from their farm to your couch. From delicious THC gummies, smooth vape pens, to premium THC flower, Mood has it all. And everything's federally legal under the 2018 Farm Bill. Yeah, this isn't some loophole. It's the real deal. Head to Mood.com and use code FIRST20 for 20% off your first order. That's MOOD.com. Find your mood.
The liberal globalist order is on its brink and awakening a new conservative age. I'm Dr. Steve Turley. Join me every day as we discover answers to today's toughest challenges and explore the revitalization of conservative civilization. This is Turley Talks.
I remember I, along with probably most people, were saying at the beginning, by the 4th of July, somebody had a thing of how the country was, the economy was going to be tanked by then. The stock market is at record highs. I know not everybody lives by the stock market, but I also drive around. I don't see a country in a depression at all. I see people out there just living their lives. And I would have thought, and I got to own it, that these tariffs were going to sink this economy by this time, and they didn't.
Hey gang, it's me, Dr. Steve. And did you see Bill Maher actually just made quite the admission? He admitted he was wrong, dead wrong about the economy under Donald Trump. In his most recent podcast, Maher openly admitted that he was wrong, particularly about Trump's tariffs. He expected Trump's policies to, in his words, quote, sink the economy by the summer of 2020. And of course, when that didn't happen, to his credit, he said, I got to own it. Trump was right. I was wrong. Now, rather than beat up on Maher, like a lot of influencers I've noticed have been doing over the last couple of days, I do think he's indicative. He's evidencing just how complicated things are right now with our economy, not just ours, but the global economy as a whole. In many respects, we're seeing something akin to what you might call a clash of economies, to play off of Sam Huntington there. There are those who claim that Trump's policies like tax cuts, deregulation, America First trade policies are inevitably going to tank the economy. But then there are those like Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent who see tariffs, lower taxes, and deregulation as sort of the three-legged stool for economic flourishing and prosperity. But are both sides missing something here? That was certainly Elon Musk's concern about the big, beautiful bill. For example, interest on the debt now actually tops defense spending, eating 13% of every federal dollar. Even after it was announced that June saw the first budget surplus in two decades, the deficit still sits at $1.3 trillion. And as much as they might tout themselves to be fiscal hawks, let's admit it, Republicans as well as Democrats inevitably win votes by spending, not saving. But what's so interesting here is that in the midst of all of this economic complexity, there's a revolution happening in money, a cyber revolution led by the rise of Bitcoin. Cryptocurrency, in many respects, is bypassing the old Bretton Woods global financial system and providing a very real and vibrant alternative. And even Washington's getting on board. Trump's strategic Bitcoin reserve is a bold move to embrace financial innovation. It's helped stabilize crypto markets and position America as a leader in digital finance. So as one financial system appears to be at its brink, a new one appears to be dawning, with America at the apex of both. So what sense should we make of all this? Well, here today to discuss this increasingly complex economic cosmos is Lynn Alden, a macroeconomist and highly respected expert in the field of investment and cryptocurrency, and the author of the groundbreaking book, Broken Money. Lynn, welcome. Great to see you again.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Well, it's an honor to have you. So let's start with this. I guess I'm calling it sort of, I'm playing off of the clash of civilizations here, this clash of economies or economic theories. As I understand it, Trump's policies basically constitute a three-legged stool. So tariff revenue to offset the annual deficit, lower taxes, and deregulation to spur economic growth. Now, you're thinking big level here. In your estimation, how is that working thus far? What are the critics of Trump's policies getting right, and what are they getting wrong?
Yeah, good set of questions. The answer for most of these things, most of the time, is that the policies that are kind of put top down on the economy, while they do matter on the margins, they tend not to radically change the direction of things. And so, for example, if you were to look at most economic metrics over the past year, 3 years, you wouldn't be able to identify the clean break between administrations, for example.
Interesting.
So, you know, unemployment bottomed at 3.4% back in 2023. It's up to 4.1. It's been roughly 4.1 for something like a year now. You know, a lot of economic metrics are like that. Same thing for the deficit spending in recent years. And when we look at the tariff revenue specifically, we're talking in the ballpark of tens of billions of revenue so far, new revenue added. And that's on top of what is estimated to be something like a $30 trillion annualized economy. And so while these policies are material, they are not necessarily the big game changers, especially because they're one variable among many. And so, you know, whenever I'm kind of analyzing these policies, I try to take them as a one at a time and then put them back into a sum of whole. So, for example, certain things like the, you know, we're focusing more on energy abundance. I think that's kind of pretty good across the board. The issue with the tariffs, I think that one of the biggest challenges so far is not necessarily the levels per se, but the lack of clarity about what they might look like 3 months from now, 6 months from now. So if you're a business, a lot of times you're kind of frozen in indecision until you have more information. I think we roughly hit peak uncertainty in April. The markets, you know, they threw a little fit, both the bond market, the currency market, the stock market, that, you know, we kind of de-escalated or pushed things away gradually and kind of started taking these one more step at a time. And so I think by a lot of metrics, we're kind of in sort of a stall speed, which is that there are some things about the economy that are propelling it. So, for example, we're still running historically pretty high deficits. That tends to be stimulatory, but also somewhat inflationary. On the other hand, we're kind of putting the brakes on things. So we've obviously had the central bank that's got interest rates still pretty high. That's putting the brake on a lot of things, especially the housing market. And tariffs right now are kind of the wild card in the middle, which is that they're kind of a brake on the economy, but they're not as severe as the ones that were initially proposed back in April. And we're still in kind of a gray area for what they're going to look like over the rest of this administration.
What about the whole issue of spending? So we met up at the Bitcoin conference in Vegas, and you have I think people are even making T-shirts out of this now. You know, there's no stopping this train. You have been officially you've made it into pop culture with this. It does seem like you're arguing, at least at a fundamental level. I love how you put it. You can look at a chart over the course of, say, 20 years, not even see a slight bit of break between administrations. That fundamentally, something is basically flawed in our system, not just our system, sort of the global monetary system. You write about this in your book, Broken Money. Can you explain to our listeners a bit what the issues are with the, particularly this, what we call the fiat system?
Sure. I think the biggest takeaway is that it was mostly a technological outcome, which is to say that if you look at most history books of money, they'll focus on decisions that politicians made at given times. And those are, of course, highly relevant, especially in a given country. But some of the biggest things that I think go under the radar are the technological changes that happen. And so one of the things I argue is that one of the biggest changes that happened to money was the invention of the telegraph. Ever since we invented it, and then specifically when we deployed it over long distances decades later, we entered a world where transactions could move at the speed of light, because the transaction is simple as an agreement, but final settlement still moved at the speed of matter, basically transporting and auditing something like physical gold. And so roughly for a century and a half, we've been in this kind of weird intermediate stage.
Yeah.
where we sped up transactions, but not final settlements. So we became very reliant on these big centralized ledgers to basically bridge the gap. That gave a lot of power to banking systems and, of course, central banks and their governments, nation states. And that's who runs the big ledgers. And it really wasn't until the invention of Bitcoin that we finally had an alternative of decentralized final settlement. But even then, I mean, that started at zero, and it's growing. You know, now it's a $2 trillion plus network, growing into a much larger existing network. And so I would say one of the challenges of the fiat currency era is we have this speed mismatch, and therefore we're kind of more reliant than we've ever been historically on these big centralized managers of ledgers. We somewhat feel it less in the United States than globally. But for example, in Africa, there's over 40 currencies. In Latin America, there's over 30 currencies. Every cross-border transaction or lending is a point of friction. And we also create these kind of global imbalances, which is to say, I mean, we were just talking about tariffs and trade in general. Part of the reason we have in the U.S. structural trade deficits is because the entire world uses our currency as a global reserve currency. Yeah. So they kind of structurally have this excess demand for it. Therefore, they structurally overvalue it. And therefore, some of our low margin stuff becomes pretty uncompetitive to make here, even compared to other developed countries. And so basically, the way we supply the world with the dollars that they use is through trade deficits. And running a couple years of trade deficits is not the end of the world. But when you run trade deficits for 40 plus years, because it's structurally embedded, that starts to become a national security issue. That becomes a rising issue of populism, because there are some people that are benefiting from that arrangement. There are other people that are on the wrong side of that arrangement, and they start to get critical mass in terms of politics. And I think what we're seeing is kind of the later stage period of that, when you have these imbalances in place for many decades, and people are increasingly pushing back on those imbalances.
Yeah. Do you see the Bretton Woods system salvable at this point, or is this something that's just going to have to buy? Because it sounds to me like you're saying there is an inherent tension, technological tension, between the speed by which a transaction could be made, but the lag inevitably in terms of fulfilling it, given our sort of, you know, second industrial revolution, temporal spatial limitations there. And even with the dollar being the default currency that then plants all this excess international dollar in our T-bills, keeping us in debt. I mean, is there any saving this, or is this just going to have to, eventually its Jurassic period?
I think it'll eventually go through a pretty big reset period. But I tend to argue that the current period can often last longer than people think. Mm-hmm. It kind of my nothing stops this train term that I kind of repopularized after, of course, the show Breaking Bad, is to point out that, you know, the U.S. fiscal deficits, for example, are, in my opinion, not going down anytime soon, but they're also not necessarily going to blow up the system anytime soon. So, mm-hmm. If we were having this conversation 5 or 10 years from now, many things will look different. But I do think that the system will still be in this kind of current trajectory, mm-hmm. so to speak, and that these big changes take usually a generation or two to really kind of work through. And so my expectation is, you know, we're going to see ongoing major currency debasement for many years. I don't really view that the current system or the prior Bretton Woods system as salvageable in their current states. I think that they are byproducts of this era where fast transactions existed, but not fast settlements. Mm-hmm. They were all basically attempts at band-aiding, that mismatch. And so I think it's really going to come down to what fast settlements look like over the next couple decades. And of course, I'm on the bull side of that, which is I think they'll be increasingly relevant in this, you know, more multipolar world, this mm-hmm. less trusting world, where instead of relying on a handful of really big central managers of ledgers, we do have these centralized alternatives now.
Yeah, it's incredible. And I think our listeners, if they haven't availed themselves of your work prior to this, they can obviously tell you know quite a bit about the history of money, particularly from commodity-based systems, fiat currencies, and the like. Are there any broad lessons from monetary history that you think are most relevant for understanding the particular challenges we're facing in 2025 and how they can actually even guide future reforms. Obviously, it seems to me just this whole now Bitcoin or crypto reserve they're creating seems like DC is trying to position itself into the future of money and like.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the history kind of shows that we go through these big pendulum shifts. And one of the most interesting ones is the long-term debt cycle, which is basically that private sector debt gradually builds up over the course of a couple generations. Mm-hmm. Then it gets so extreme that it blows up. We saw this back in the late 1920s, and we saw it again in 2008. By many metrics, they were quite similar in terms of just how much private sector debt had built up and then started to pop, and we hit zero interest rates in both cases. And historically, rather than letting that deleverage nominally, they tend to start rotating some of that debt onto the public ledger. So that's where you see bigger fiscal responses, you see more monetary debasement, and you kind of smooth over that implosion by putting more on the sovereign level. And then you usually get like a second hit in the subsequent decades, which is tends to be more inflationary and more currency debasement. So back in history, that was the 1940s era. There's obviously a lot else going on as well. And now we're in the 2020s era, which is we're more driven by sovereign deficits, or more we're talking about interest on the U.S. debt rather than, say, the major impact on the private sector. Right. And so I think we've kind of firmly entered this more sovereign level where and one of the closest things I think you want to study probably is the 1940s period, you know, less about the total war scenario, but more about that kind of command and control type of economic approach, at least around the margins, that tends to show up in these types of environments.
Yeah, that's so interesting, because that's also when you start to see, you know, the whole beginning of the Bretton Woods system and the IMF coming in, the WTO, the World Bank and the like, sort of the beginning of that liberal international order, post-World War II order.
Look, if you're still buying weed from some guy named Trevor in a parking lot, you're doing it wrong. Mood.com delivers legal THC products straight to your door. Gummies, vapes, flower, the good stuff. No sketchy DMs, no med card. Just add to cart, check out, and boom, it's at your doorstep. It's legal in all 50 states, thanks to the Farm Bill, and Mood's products actually work. Seriously, this isn't gas station garbage. It's small batch, lab-tested, real results. Go to Mood.com, use code FIRST20 for 20% off, and never run dry again. That's Mood.com. Go get lit, legally.
So I'm curious, you know, so we're talking about like, kind of going outside an alternative to this Brentwood system. And the two commodities I think of immediately are gold and Bitcoin, you know, which to me is kind of like this Archeo future sort of structure, which I love. I love both. I love gold. I love Bitcoin. I'm curious how you see gold and Bitcoin, literally this Archeo future money, coexisting, say in a portfolio, and under what conditions might one outperform the other? I know Mike Saylor is kind of like, yeah, gold is just going to go the way of the dodo bird itself, and it's all going to go Bitcoin. But what do you see?
Well, the short answer is I've been bullish on both, and I've been recommending both from an investing perspective. We can talk about their importance geopolitically or investing-wise. Investing-wise, I've been emphasizing basically, if you start with something like a 60-40 portfolio, which is like 60% stocks, 40% bonds, if you wanted to fix that toward the current era, my argument is replace some of the bonds with gold. And consider replacing some of the equities with Bitcoin, just because we're talking about two very different levels of volatility. Right. Another way of kind of putting it is that gold is you know, a $20 trillion asset, and Bitcoin is a $2 trillion asset. Bitcoin is, of course, you know, a 16-year-old asset. It's growing into whatever it might become. And so generally speaking, Bitcoin has given you much better returns. And I would estimate that the next 5-10 years is probably going to continue. But that comes with greater volatility and uncertainty along the way. So I think that the Bitcoin's growing into what it's going to become, whereas gold is, you know, historically already there. When we look at it at a geopolitical level, it's mostly a question of kind of central banks versus others. So, for example, ever since 2009, gold has been gradually reasserting itself into the global kind of central bank reserve system. So prior to then, the tonnage of gold held as reserves around the world was gradually diminishing. And around 2009, they started gradually going back up. And then in 2022, we saw like another spike up to some extent in enthusiasm by central banks for gold. And of course, when, you know, the two benefits of gold are it's much harder to debase than the sovereign bonds of other countries, and they can't be frozen or confiscated with a stroke of a pen if they're held in your own jurisdiction. And so there's been more of an interest among countries of having a percentage of their reserves to have those qualities. And you know, one of the challenges, one of the things where Bitcoin can matter, I think, on the geopolitical scale, is that a lot of these countries are trying to build like alternative payment or settlement systems.
Yeah.
You know, the BRICS have been talking about this for quite a long time. You know, there's things around the margins.
Something outside of SWIFT, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And these things are the network effects are very challenging to deal with. Yeah. And one of the things that is interesting about Bitcoin is that it has some of the same qualities of gold, which you can hold it. You know, central bank or any other entity can hold it. They can hold their own keys. It can't be just easily debased. Right. But it's also a settlement system that is more efficient than gold, with the caveat that it's very volatile and it's 16 years old. So until fairly recently, it's been too small to be on the scale that central banks might find useful. But as you know, now we're talking about a $2 trillion plus network. And in the years ahead, if it doubles and doubles again, this is actually a pretty big relevant network for them now that as they're trying to build their kind of closed source alternatives, there's also this open source one that they can latch on to or build on or leverage in various ways. So I do think that at least as an alternative, it is starting to catch the eye of policymakers around the world.
Yeah, I heard about the BRICS countries considering using something akin to, or actually using Bitcoin as their currency. It'll be interesting. Yeah, they haven't come to a conclusion yet on that. That's for sure. When did you get into Bitcoin? Was it like 2019? I'm forgetting what my reading of your resume, or not your bio. When did you get into Bitcoin?
So my first article on it was 2017.
2017,
Yeah, but I really started to pound the table on it in April 2020. It went through another cycle, was in the bear market at the time. We were having the big liquidity effects of that whole, you know, that whole era. And so that's when I started to say, you know, it went from being interesting to being actually like a high probability outcome for a while.
Yeah, I think what was your article, why I'm bullish on Bitcoin, was that the 2017?
The one in 2017 was how to value Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies. The 2021 was three reasons I'm bullish on Bitcoin.
Three reasons. It was that was a really good read. You know, I'd say probably half our audience are all in on Bitcoin, crypto, DeFi, all that. The other half are still kind of like, I don't know about that. I don't know if it's real money. You've heard all the arguments from your perspective. You know, what are the most compelling reasons for Bitcoin's long-term value? And you know, what would you say to people who might still be skeptical of its potential? Maybe I wouldn't say a Peter Schiff or anything, who actually just lives and breathes that skepticism, he gives good arguments, but you know, just somebody who's still not quite convinced.
I think the best thing I could do is share what got me over the line, because I was skeptical even though I was interested. For me, my biggest hang up was the idea that, you know, Bitcoin is interesting and Bitcoin is scarce, but anyone can copy it. So what makes it just not copyable into oblivion? And one of my kind of key observations that got me over that hang up was really analyzing the details of its network effect and how communication protocols spread. And so, for example, you know, we're having this conversation over the internet. The internet runs on Ethernet. It runs on internet protocol. Email runs on simple mail transfer protocol. Universal serial bus is very popular for, you know, physical connections. Once something becomes established, even though there's many ways to make alternatives, those standards tend to persist for quite a while. And they become self-reinforcing, because part of the reason why Ethernet is so popular is because billions of devices already have Ethernet. And so if you were to come up with something marginally better, it wouldn't matter, because you're up against such an entrenched communication standard. And I basically have observed that Bitcoin kind of reached that status with as the way to communicate value on the internet, which is to say it's a $2 trillion network. It's been the biggest cryptocurrency for 16 years in a row. It's got the most liquidity. It's got the most security. Yeah. It's got the kind of the simplest design to be robust. It's proof of work. And so I've what I generally argue is that in a world of these centralized ledgers, so there's, you know, the US system, there's BRICS are working on their own system. China's got their own system. There's, you know, all these different centralized ledgers around the world. Bitcoin is the preeminent decentralized ledger, which I argue has value. It's, you know, if you look at most estimates of how much assets there are in the world, Bitcoin is worth something like 0.2% of global assets, with gold being about 2% of global assets, 10 times bigger. I think Bitcoin will continue to grow in market share of that. And I think its network effects keep it well positioned to remain decentralized and secure. Another way of putting it is that basically Bitcoin is the most immutable database that people have built yet. If you were to stick something in, you know, an Apple database or a Microsoft database, you know, it can be deleted. And whereas Bitcoin, it's basically this big distributed system.
Yeah.
And the killer app for that is money. So basically, all it really is at the end of the day is a decentralized Excel spreadsheet, more or less. But it's got this ongoing security network effect around it that puts it as a leader, similar to Ethernet, similar to Simple Mail Transfer Protocol, similar to even a spoken language. There's a reason why languages tend to persist for a very long time. They have self-reinforcing network effects. And I think the argument for Bitcoin is that it's the preeminent way to transfer portable value and the preeminent way to do decentralized money in the world.
Yeah, brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. And it's the next phase of the technology of money, as it were, moving into the cyberspace and the like. Well, I mean, I'm just curious, have you followed some of Peter Schiff's arguments against it? And if so, could you identify just maybe perhaps the most, what you believe in your opinion, just sort of the biggest oversight in his argument? Because he seems to be a good faith fellow in terms of trying to, you know, keep the crypto world honest. But he also seems to, he just seems to miss something. Have you identified it?
Well, yeah. So Peter and I have met a couple times, behind the scenes at these conferences. You know, he's always friendly. I think that there's a hang up around the physicality of it. I would say, I don't make his arguments for him, but basically, sometimes it can be hard to understand why something that's intangible has value. Gold, you can touch it. You can wear it, you can do things with it. Bitcoin, people often say that it has no intrinsic value, so how could it have monetary value? I generally think that what people are somewhat missing are one, there is a physical aspect to it. There are physical miners and energy that goes into keeping it decentralized and working. So even though, you know, we're mostly moving around numbers and we're managing a ledger, it is tied to the physical world. Two, those network effects and those attributes that it provides are very important. And so the non-monetary use case is basically a decentralized ledger, a decentralized database. The monetary use case is that by extension, it's the best way you could self-custody portable value. So if I wanted to travel around the world, I live part of each year in Egypt. So I go back and forth
to
United States and Egypt. I can't bring my gold with me every time. I can only bring so many physical dollars, or we get weird looks at the airport and, you know, risk all that. But you can memorize 12 numbers and bring things around the world. And I think in a world where that is true. And again, I mentioned there's, you know, you have to think globally. So there's 40 plus currencies in Africa. There's 30 plus currencies in Latin America. There's capital controls everywhere. There is a demand that people have for a decentralized, portable, very hard to debase, very hard to censor money. And because of the nature of network effects and liquidity and security, it's something that resists, you know, the fact that it can just become distributed and there can be a million cryptocurrencies. Because at the end of the day, there still tends to be centralization around whatever the leading one is, which is Bitcoin.
Right. All right. Well said, for sure. All right. Last one. And I just want to nerd out with you a little bit. I have seen you did a little writing on the fourth turning, which I think is pretty cool. The cyclical theory on how generational shifts inevitably result in often dramatic political, economic, cultural transformations. And I know you've drawn from that theory a bit. Can you give us a sense of how we are in the midst right now of a fourth turning?
So I like to look at some of the quantifiable aspects of it. So, you know, people often criticize it and say that it's like horoscopes or it's qualitative. What I found, what kind of drew me to it, is that when you look at the history of that and then you map that onto the long-term debt cycle, which I talked about earlier, so that the buildup of private debt and then that bubble kind of blowing up and then the reflating of it on the sovereign level, those events tend to mark what a fourth turning is. Yeah. That's when things start changing dramatically. And so when I kind of put out the long-term chart of, say, the monetary base as a percentage of GDP, or private debt and public debt as a percentage of GDP, and if you map that out over like a 120-year period, for example, and then you kind of outline on it what are the fourth turnings, it'll very clearly match that situation. Wow. And so what I find interesting about the fourth turning is that that's kind of discussing at least that author's or the co-author's view of what's going on socially at that time, which agree with it or disagree with it, at least it's a lens to look through. Yes. It in addition to others. And so as I look at the numbers and as I kind of look at the quantifiable aspects, it still is useful to have that social element in mind. Some of the things that stand out to me is one, institutions that were built, you know, four generations ago, they've gone through periods of entropy, periods of really no longer reflecting the environment that they're in now. And so new institutions are built. I've generally argued that Bitcoin is one of those institutions. It's not necessarily the institution in the centralized sense, but it's a new thing. Mm-hmm. that kind of has sprung up in the modern era, and it challenges some of those older institutions, for example. Yeah. That's just, it's one of many. So I think the refreshing of institutions is highly relevant. And then also the kind of cycles of populism that tend to happen. Yes. So we talked before about if you run structural trade deficits for many decades, don't be shocked when you start to get populism as pushback. Right. And so people often ask, how long can this go? And it's to some extent, it's a mathematical answer, but then there's also a social answer as well, which is that when you do start to have these things build up, you start to get increasing pushback against it. And it's useful to have a mind for history to really see how that kind of went through in the past. So I think it's useful to kind of combine the qualitative and quantitative aspects.
Yes. I love it. Absolutely love it. Lynn, where can our audience keep up with your amazing work? I know you have a website, you have X handle. Where can they check you out?
So people can find me at lynnalden.com. If they're on X, it's @LynnAldenContact. And they can also check out Broken Money on Amazon or wherever else they purchase books.
Oh, it's wonderful. Yeah, gang, if you do want this dive deeper here, grab a copy of Lynn's Broken Money. It is a must read. Check out all of her platforms, which are all linked down below. You will not be disappointed. And I love is it a monthly newsletter that you do on the lynnalden.com? Is that
every 6 weeks? Yeah, eight
every
times
six
a year.
Weeks. Yeah. It's excellent. Again, it's just so chock full of information. It'll blow your mind. Lynn, thank you so much. Let's have you back soon. This is wonderful.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Turley Talks podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, leave us a 5-star review, and share this episode with your friends. Help us defeat the fake news media and rank as the #1 news and commentary podcast all over the world. Come back again tomorrow for another episode celebrating the rise of a new conservative age.
Does your employer pay for training or education that could help you in your job today? Then, IT folks, this is for you. CBT Nuggets offers online IT training that's affordable and, dare we say, fun. From networking and cybersecurity to data science, CBT Nuggets has the training to get you through the workday. With our courses, you'll build real-world skills with short, engaging videos, hands-on virtual labs, and quiz questions to test what you've learned. Go to cbtnuggets.com and check it out. Our online platform launches right in your browser. No expensive hardware or software is needed to start. The best part? You can watch and learn at your own pace, on your schedule. cbtnuggets.com. It's IT training for all levels. From beginner-level courses to advanced network training, our expert instructors give you information that's informative, meaningful, and engaging. We've been helping learners for over 25 years, and we're a trusted name in IT training. So tell your boss it's time for CBT Nuggets IT training. Go to cbtnuggets.com and get started today.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.